All right, everyone. Welcome to episode 10 of the IO podcast.
We made it to double digits.
Double digits. This is one we wanted to do very early. In fact, for those who watched all our episodes, you'll remember the conversation we had with Keith Raboy, where Keith mentions the guy that he's chasing, Scott Sandell. He kind of called Scott the MJ of our game right now, and we put it in our head like we've got to go meet Scott. The fortunate thing is that we got to know Scott over the last 5-6 years because he was on Divi's board of directors. NEA led Divi's Series C, so that's another personal connection we have, and we finally were able to have the conversation with him.
Excited for it. Hope you all like it.
So, Scott, we're excited to be here. Here's a fun question Sterling and I have for you to kick things off. In one of our early episodes, we met with Keith Raboy. Do you know Keith from Founders Fund?
Yeah, sure.
Keith, in the middle of the conversation, we asked him, like, hey, how do you measure your career? Like, what's your goal? And he says, I want to have the most IPOs of any investor who's ever lived.
Okay.
And we said, all right, well, who has that record right now? And he says, I think it's Scott at NEA. So at that moment, Sterling and I knew we had to come and talk to you about that. And so the first question we have, Scott, is, do you track stuff like that? And if so, what's the number?
I don't honestly know what the number is. And I don't know if I have the most.
Okay.
There are probably some people who have more like back in time.
I do think Keith was talking about active. So do you think you're number one when it comes to active?
Probably, yes.
Okay.
That I probably am, yeah.
And rough number?
A dozen.
I think he might have said 14 or something.
12
like
to
that.
14, somewhere in there.
Yeah, he's tracking you pretty closely. So he's
yeah, that's great.
to be fair, he said, like, I want to be the Michael Jordan of my sport. And right now, you know, that's you. So of those 12, 14 IPOs, what are the most consistent things that you pull out, like the similarities either in the founders or in the wave that they were riding? Like, what are the common denominators of those companies?
They all have exceptional people. You know, you don't make it that far down the path without having exceptional founders. Sometimes the founders are the right people to go the distance. That is not 100% of the time. You know, I just had a really nice email exchange with Frank Slootman because Frank, as you probably saw, retired from running Snowflake. That's his third successful company. I was lucky enough to give Frank his first job as a CEO. So one of my IPOs was Data Domain.
Yeah.
You know, we started that company in our office. And in 2001, when Kai Lee took a sabbatical from Princeton, called Forrest Basket, and the three of us had lunch in November of 2000, I guess it was. And Kai became an entrepreneur in residence.
Yeah.
I won't take you through that whole story, but Kai was very clear up front that he did not want to be the CEO. He wanted to go back to Princeton after his sabbatical. So we knew from the outset we'd have to find a great CEO. And so you have to have a great CEO, whether it's the founder or somebody else. There are no companies that make it that far without a great CEO.
How often does the founder recognize that they might, when they're not the person to go the entire distance, how often does the founder recognize it versus the investors have to help them recognize it?
I'd say maybe 50-50. Maybe a little bit more, they need a nudge. And there's a reason for that. I learned about that very early in my career. A very strange thing happened. This was in 1999, and I was competing for this company called Centerbeam, and it was, you know, super hot time, and I was still a young pup in this business, you know, penny waiting for change, and competing with all these, you know, famous guys, and for some reason I won. And so I sat down with Sheldon Laub, he was a seasoned entrepreneur. He'd been successful before. I forget the companies he started, but you know, he could take money from anybody. And there were four founders of Centerbeam. And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of curious, like, why did you guys pick me? And they said, well, we talked about it. And we felt like you were the one person who we would trust to tell us if we had to go.
What do you think you did that showed them that you were willing to do that? Like, how did you earn that trust?
And that's pre
them?
Like a reputation. So it must've been something in your interactions with them.
I think that's all they had to go on Sterling. I don't know. Yeah. I honestly don't know how they reached that conclusion, mm-hmm. Tyler. It's hard to know, but it was the point of that story was more, you know, so I failed to tell you the second part of what Sheldon said, which is he said, what I know is that as the founder and CEO, I have to have complete trust in myself. Hmm. And because of that, I can never doubt myself. And it's going to take somebody else to help me realize that I'm not any longer the right person. And so I thought that was incredibly insightful,
yeah.
You know, and I think that is the crux of the problem though, right? Like you have to believe in yourself no matter what. As to be a successful CEO, you have to ignore a lot of other inputs,
yeah,
all the time, right? You have to have the confidence of your convictions. And so sometimes you run out of, you know, headroom and you're not any longer the right person. And sometimes because you have to have that conviction, somebody else has to tell you like, gee whiz, you know, there's another way.
It makes perfect sense.
And there are better way and worse ways to do that. And better and worse outcomes when that happens. And unfortunately I've been through a lot of those transitions and, you know, but I think the thing I would say is that, if you can find a founder who can take it the whole way and they're the right person at each stage, that is the best outcome. And for a couple simple reasons. One, they're by definition owners.
Yeah.
Right? It's their baby.
It's their baby.
Forget how much they have on the cap table, yeah. Right? But that ownership mentality is vital. And then they never give up. You know, they're all in. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Right? These are founders. And those characteristics, to your original question, Sterling, are the kind of things that make the difference in the end. Because there is no linear path to an IPO and beyond. Every single company, you know, has to pivot, has to go through hard times, all of these things which require, guess what? Original thought. You know, there is no, you are, you know, when you're a pioneer, there are no maps, said one of my founders, K.R. Schreeder, one of the great ones. You know, you're always like, there's nobody else to follow. You're figuring it out. Every single story is a unique story. And so the founder is typically, not always, but typically doing it for the first time as the CEO. And I'm a huge fan of first-time CEOs. Frank's one of the few people I know who's done it two or three times.
Yeah.
And why is that? Because it's very rare for somebody to have two characteristics that you have when you're a first-time CEO. One, you're really hungry. You're going to be sweating, you know, everything. And there's a sort of level of commitment that comes with the risk of it being your career.
Yeah.
Right? So there's that. But also, when you're doing it for the first time, you're thinking through everything from first principles. And sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong. But since every situation is unique, you know, you're not sort of falling prey to, I was successful before, and this is what worked before, therefore it's the right thing to do here.
Trying
to follow a map, right? There is, you know, there are plenty of things you can learn from experience.
Yeah.
But on balance, it's not to say somebody can't be successful. Frank's done it three times.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you have to remain open-minded. And so, that's a hard thing for people to do when they're really successful.
Yeah.
This is like a remarkably important point because I couldn't figure out forever why the first time VP seemed to like figure stuff out that nobody could. And you just articulated it as best as I've ever heard it. It's because you don't have the breadth of experience to just know what every best practice is. So everything is first principles thinking from the get-go.
It has to be.
And you will find some things that are better than best practices because best practices, once they're best practices, are by definition average. There's no more alpha there. So you have to think, you have to be creative, you have to forge your own path, and you do make some mistakes because you also don't know everything that somebody else might know. But on net, it seems like you come out ahead.
I think so. You combine that with the edge that you have because you're not resting on your laurels. Mm-hmm. It's all of your eggs are in this basket. You don't have another basket of eggs from the last one.
Yeah.
So come back to your first question of it takes exceptional people, makes a ton of sense, but how do you identify these people and what are some of the things that they do that make you think, all right, this guy's, their gal is special? What are common traits you notice that make you say that's them?
Well, first of all, a lot of it is about what their motivations are. You know, I mean, it's sort of a common belief system anyway in the venture capital business now that, you know, it's too hard to start a company as a way to make money. Mm-hmm. So you got to be in it
a little irrational.
You got to be in it for something more than that, right? You got to be mission driven in some way, shape, or form. And part of what you need to have a real passion around is building a business. It's not just solving a problem, because in order to be the CEO, you have to want to build a business. And there's that element. And so sometimes somebody has a mission and they're passionate about it. They need somebody else to help them build the business. Doesn't mean they can't stay in the company and do important things.
Yeah.
But there's something in that.
Okay. So mission driven, you talked about first principles thinking. Are you just picking up on this in their pitch, or like, how do you
so
tell?
So what I like to do is I like to get to know people, and I want to know, you know, if you just spend an hour and a half with somebody.
Yeah.
And you ask them one simple question, Tyler, Sterling, how did you get to this room on this day? I want you to tell me where you started your life. I want you to tell me what happened early in your life that made you who you are. Maybe it was one day on the playground in fourth grade. Maybe it was something you did in high school. Maybe it's your family situation and something you learned from your grandfather. It's all those things. I want to hear about those things. And then when you got to the point where you started being able to make choices for yourself, you know, maybe it was going to college. What options did you generate for yourself? Why were those interesting to you? Why did you pick one? Was that a good decision or not? Take me through that chapter. Then how did your interests evolve? What options did you generate? What decision did you make? Go through that decision tree of life up to today. Okay, you're going to get 100 on this part of the test. Second part of the test is the next 10 years. I want to know, what are you going to tell me when we have this conversation in 10 years? Mm-hmm. Because that gives me insight into what your dreams are. And if your dreams for the next 10 years correspond to the level of achievement that you have exhibited and the perseverance and the ambition and the humility and all the things that form the character that you are today, if that's a match with what you want to do in the future, then I'm pretty excited.
Because you can see a slope.
You can see the slope of that line, Tyler. Yeah. And it's like, you know what? You can just put a dot all through all these points in history, and it's going to tell you what the future looks like. Now, it doesn't mean everybody succeeds. So that gets us to the second part of the equation. What are you setting out to do? Mm-hmm. There are great people who have a burning mission to do something. It's not a venture capital startup, mm-hmm. right? It shouldn't be. Like, it should be a nonprofit, or it should be something else, or it's just not a big enough opportunity. That's not bad. It just means it's not for us, right? You know, the venture capital model, as you guys very well know, applies to certain kinds of businesses where, first of all, there is an opportunity to become very large and valuable, and you need to have capital to do it relatively quickly to beat out all the other people who will necessarily pursue any opportunity of that magnitude. Because at any point in history, when the conditions present themselves for somebody to start a company to solve that problem,
you're not the only one. Yeah.
You're not the only one. So you're going to be at the starting line with four or five other teams in a normal scenario, and you need to have the capital to win, and you need to have the people on your team to win. That means not just the people who work for you, but the people on your team, on your board, your investors, the whole collection.
So you just kind of walked us through the process and understanding who somebody is, getting to know them, the beginning of their life to this day, the future. How often do you feel like you get it right? Meaning what you originally thought when you were going through that process turns out you feel like, yeah, I got that one right versus I got that one wrong. Because you think about hiring, and even great hiring managers, they have a lot of mishires. It's just hard to do that without a ton of data. So how often do you go through that process, make a decision, and then feel like you got it right versus feel like, oh, I missed something?
I feel like we make good decisions the majority of the time, maybe 70-80% of the time. But of course, when you're making investment decisions to invest in a company, which by definition is a very high risk endeavor,
yeah,
you are going to have bad outcomes.
Yep.
For whatever set of reasons.
But the process worked.
But the process of getting 70-80% decision making is right. That yields, by the way, if you look at the normal distribution of outcomes, probably 25 or 30% sheer failures.
Mm-hmm.
The bulk of them are, you know, okay outcomes, and a very small number, as you guys know, are the reason this industry exists.
So on that point, I mean, Sterling and I look at the investments you've made, and I mean, we're talking what Workday and Salesforce and Plaid and Robinhood, and we thought, man,
Divvy.
Yeah, a little Divvy. We'd love to talk to you about all of these. Like, what's one of your favorite companies that you've worked with, Scott? And I'm not saying pick your favorite, but what's one of them that you just absolutely loved that we could maybe hear a little bit more about and the story behind it?
I mean, of course, I love all of them.
Exactly.
Right? But one that usually comes to mind for me is Tableau.
Okay, awesome.
And that's because there are a couple things that are a little unusual about the Tableau journey. You know, we started out, we were fortunate enough to invest in the Series A of Tableau. We bought 20% of the company for $5 million.
Bring those days back.
Yeah, no kidding,
right? They're coming.
yeah, maybe they are. No. We could talk about that. But, you know, the thing that was special about Tableau is that these three founders were all exceptional people. You know, Pat Hanrahan is, you know, if you want to know who the Michael Jordan of, you know, technology is over at Stanford, go talk to Pat, because he's a quiet guy and you'll never hear him talk about it, but trust me, he's the real deal. And then, you know, you had Christian Chabot and Chris Stolte. Chris was one of Pat's PhD students. Christian was a friend who happened to be an MBA student at the business school. Anyway, they came together and they had a passion for solving a problem. You know, they wanted people to help people understand and visualize their data. That's what Tableau does, of course. But they pursued excellence in everything they did, starting with the product. And they had a very clear vision for that product, and they were patient.
What year was this, roughly?
2003, maybe.
Okay,
like,
so still very early cloud days. And
yeah, and it started off as a Windows desktop product, by the way.
Okay.
I was the one pushing them to get to the cloud. That took a while. But the key is that it was a journey. It was a long journey that didn't, there was never a massive disruption to what they were trying to do, even though they had 12 competitors when they went public. They kind of stuck to their knitting. They didn't look at what their competitors were doing because they had this clear vision for the product. You know, I worried about us getting disrupted along the way, but they were there. They could see on the ground what was happening with competitors and customers and stuff. And they're like, no, we're on a unique path here. And they were. And then, you know, because it was a relatively slow journey, and this is one of the big lessons for me from Tableau, and one of the reasons I bring up this example, is that they were a pretty slow company to get to $10 million of revenue. And I don't remember, but it was probably 5 years or something like that.
Okay.
They were the fastest growing software company in history from that point forward for a couple years after their IPO. That is not an accident. Okay. Why is that? It's because they slowly built that foundation, not just product, but organization, customers that love them, you know, all this different stuff. And the result was that their team, the original management team, was able to grow with that business so that they only replaced one VP level person from very early days through the IPO. And that is a huge advantage when you are working with the same group of, you guys had a great team at Divvy, right? You remember what I'm talking about. And that makes a huge difference when you get to the point where now you need to scale, and you want to scale fast, and you have that level of trust and conviction and confidence in your teammates. That's what they had, and it was super fun to watch.
Hmm. That's incredible. So from year one to year five, when it's going pretty slow, is this when you're like, hey, everybody, are we too slow? Are we going to get beat to this opportunity? And then you felt pretty confident. Is that when you were pretty stressed, though, is those first 5 years?
All right. So think about it.
Because you got like a Josh James raising, you know, $1 billion from BlackRock to do Domo. Like, it wasn't like a sleepy space.
No, it was not. And back in those days, I was still a penny waiting for change. So, you know, I was
that's the best line.
You know, I was sort of anxious in the way you are when you're a young venture capitalist and you haven't had a lot of wins yet. And so I never forget. I go to the company was in Seattle. I go up to Forrest and I would fly up to Seattle and go to the board meeting. And it's maybe like year three, year four. And they present the business plan for the next year. And they're going to go from, I'm just making up the numbers, like 2.5 to 4 million. Okay. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, man, why can't we grow faster than that? So I said, hey, Christian, you know, I mean, I'm a patient guy, but like, can't we grow faster than 2.5 to 4 million next year?
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that was true about them, by the way, super capital efficient.
Okay.
Like, I'll come back to that, but like crazy capital efficient. Bootstrapped the company, et cetera. So he's like, no, Scott, you know, we think that's the right thing to do next year. But I'll think about it between now and the next board meeting. So he comes back to the next board meeting. And remember, this is a data visualization company. Uh-huh. These guys are driven by data. Uh-huh. So what has he done? He's gone off and he's studied all of the public software companies in history. And he's looked at their growth rates from inception. And he's figured out the best, like 25% of them or something, the fastest growing ones that grow fast forever. And he says, well, look at the data. These companies grow, they do not grow 200% a year. They do not grow 100% a year. They grow 50% a year. But they grow 50% a year forever.
For a long time.
And usually they have one anomalous year early on where they might have a spike of 100 or 200% when they go from 1 million to 3 million or whatever.
Yeah.
But from that point forward, they grow 50%. And you don't have to be a mathematician to know that that gets big fast.
So there's this old saying of like lemons ripen early. Is this similar to that of like you're willing to wait a long time to let the compounding work underneath? Is that kind of the pattern you see across some of these big companies?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, they build the foundation, mm-hmm. Tyler, so that they have something sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of companies around here, especially in the last cycle, as we all know, that raised gobs of money and figured out how to waste it. And posted pretty aggressive growth numbers.
But
and
not
then
sustainable.
It's not sustainable.
Yeah.
So is the lesson there, this is interesting, right? Is the lesson there that really good things that are going to be valuable for a long time take a long time to build?
Yep.
Probably true.
For sure.
Second thing is, if you're doing something that is overinflated, either because of the amount of money that you're burning or whatever you're doing, like if your unit economics are upside down, you're giving away, you know, a dollar for every 50 cents of revenue, stuff like that, that also comes to a head at some point. That's probably another learning from this story. Anything else, Tyler? Because that's a good one.
I think those are pretty two great ones. Well, what else?
Yeah, I mean, the corollary, of course, is, you know, if you have to fix it once it's at scale.
Really hard.
Very painful.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's also, this is another thing I think about in startups, a lot of it's momentum driven. And so like going from 2 to 4 might not seem crazy, but it is positive momentum. Whereas if you come out and you get to 10 and 30 and then, well, you're flat or you're down a little bit, like the momentum and the way that a company culture like adapts this stuff, I think is important too.
It's absolutely important.
And you said with Tableau, they did eventually inflect a little more and became the fastest growing startup or, you know, tech company from 10 onward. What caused that inflection? Was it just the foundation that finally took off, or did they have some insight on the product? Or?
Well, so even though Tableau was never a freemium model, they always had paid software. They were a product-led company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they built great product.
Yeah.
And as they built out the features of this product and the capabilities of the product, it appealed to broader and broader audiences. And so that's what drove growth. And it was always the best product. It was always a revolutionary product. And so it just, you know, the market is big, like everybody. And I would say one thing that happened that was, you know, you sort of say, sometimes luck is helpful too.
Absolutely.
Right? And, you know, when we first invested in Tableau, I'll tell you what I didn't see. I saw a company that I thought had this incredible product for the professional data analyst, business analyst inside of a company.
Yeah.
But somebody, you know, the kind of person that there aren't that many of in a given company, sure. There might be 10 or 20 or 30 of them in a sizable company,
yeah.
Who does this kind of work and feeds the results to others. What I did not see is that, and so we were thinking, you know, every company's going to buy 20 licenses of Tableau, and yeah. What happened?
Everybody.
No, everybody.
Including students. I lived students in Tableau, yeah. And I'm a moron. Like, what was cool about the product is it actually democratized, right, the entire job to some extent.
Well,
right,
and you're right. Right. It was like an early PLG, like bottoms-up thing. I remember graduate students would get licenses, and then they'd take it to their company, and it's like every single employee started to use Tableau because of that.
Absolutely.
And you would attribute that almost, you call that luck, but it's like a good thing happened that you didn't plan on.
Yeah, I didn't plan on that one.
Yeah.
This is actually like an interesting point, because a lot of times these businesses that get very large and are very durable, they almost end up building a product for customers that don't quite exist yet. You think about Stripe and like the Collison brothers, and they will say they were building Stripe for customers that didn't exist yet. You think about Shopify, there weren't a bunch of people already selling stuff on the internet. They created the product that like enabled the market and made the TAM so much bigger. And so I think that's an interesting takeaway from the Tableau story too.
Well, we like to say we invest in huge markets that don't exist yet.
Yeah. Okay, that's an NEA saying?
Yeah.
That's you guys a good look one. For that. I like that.
No, I mean, you know, because if you can create the product that enables the market or the market. Service or whatever, that's a lot easier to capture than displacing a bunch of people who are not exactly excited to give up the business to you.
For sure, absolutely.
You've given advice on one of your bios. You say that you give advice to founders to ask this question of investors. And to the investor, what would you do when we miss our plan, if and when we miss our plan? Why do you think that's a good question for founders to ask of investors?
Well, every company misses their plan sooner or later, right? And if you're a founder, you want somebody who is on the journey with you and understands that that's going to happen. And instead of saying, oh my God, you know, panic, rolls up their sleeves and says, okay, well, let's understand, well, why did that happen? And what can we do about it? I mean, I was in a board meeting recently. I'm not going to name the company, but it was one of those moments where I realized that as a board member and investor, it was our job to give the founders permission to rethink their plan, because they had missed their plan. And more importantly, they had a very ambitious set of goals in front of them that they were no longer in a position to make, because they hadn't, you know, some things needed to be done differently. If you can't have people in the room with you thinking about it that way, then it's a painful experience, because what I've seen too many times is that people who don't understand how businesses are really built and are not problem solvers will panic, and then they just become pests.
I love that. And I'm curious, though, there has to be a point at which the company misses and they misses and they misses, and you can't just be supportive the whole time at the misses, because they're missing all the time. So
right.
How do you strike that balance between, look, I get it, we're never going to be up and to the right always, but no, we're actually off track here and we have to figure something
out. It's like, when do you hold somebody accountable to something versus when do you give them permission to rethink it, and how do you use, what's your judgment like there?
Well, that's obviously an art form,
yeah,
but I think, you know, I think you start by seeing what their reaction is. You know, do they take responsibility themselves for what's just happened? Because that's when you want to help them, right? If they're, you know, naming every other reason under the sun why this happened, then it's going to be a harder conversation.
Yeah.
But if they own those results, and they themselves are struggling and feeling bad. I mean, what I saw sitting across from these two founders, just like I am with you right here today, they were feeling terrible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Those are the ones you want to help.
If they exhibit extreme ownership, you're more likely to actually buoy them up and like help them along the path. If they're not, they're avoiding responsibility, you have to bring that.
Yeah, there's
like,
this quote sense. I love of, a good leader learns how to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And it's probably true of a board member too. Like, you find out where they're at and you are the counterbalance to where they're at.
Yeah, that's right.
Because every founder is going to be different. they're going to have their different kind of like strengths and weaknesses. But what are the common things you do with every founder that you found to be helpful to them on their journey, independent of what their unique superpowers are?
Well, my simple belief is that once I've decided I believe in a founder, I believe in them 100% until I don't believe in them anymore. And I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt, maybe more than they deserve with the benefit of hindsight. So, you know, nobody should be worried they didn't have enough of a chance with me. But what that means is when you believe in somebody 100%, you are with them trying to help solve problems, and hopefully they are taking accountability for the results, which good founders do. And so you're a partner to them. And and that's a very powerful thing. When somebody is your boss, if a founder views you as their boss, which sometimes they do, that's a very different dynamic. You know, we don't aspire to be anybody's boss. Mm-hmm. We do aspire to be people's partners.
Mm-hmm. If a relationship is not going in that direction, where it's less partnership and more adversarial, what do you do as an investor to fix that?
Because you're working with some pretty strong-willed people, right?
Well, the opportunities to fix that, you have to be patient, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. And you have to wait for the right opportunity to fix that, which is usually when something happens that causes them to lose the moral high ground a little bit.
So maybe they're a little more humble and open to talking about it.
That's it.
Yeah. Okay. So timing is maybe the key there. All right.
Yeah. But you have to be patient, right? Like, you know, you get in, you know, you're in a hot market and they got something really cool and, you know, they think their stuff doesn't smell and, you know, all that. And you gotta go along with that for a while. And then when there's an opportunity, you know, and they're realizing that maybe they're human after all, you know, then you step up to them as another human and say, okay, well.
The last question before we move on from this is, and you've talked about it a little bit, is when things go wrong, what do you advise founders to do in terms of dealing with their investors? When bad news comes up, missed plan, something goes, whatever it is, how do you like that to be? Because I think a lot of instinctual from founders is you kind of like hide it and hope nobody finds out about it. But what would your advice be to people about how to deliver bad news?
Well, first of all, that's a reasonable sort of operating assumption if you don't have trust that the people on the other side of that conversation are going to treat you like a partner.
Yep.
Right? So if you've built the right kind of relationship with your board members and they trust you, you trust them, then it's a lot easier to have that conversation, yeah. right? Because you don't fear that they're going to freak out. Mm-hmm. You know that they feel like they're on your team,
yeah.
right? And so you can, and that just makes it easier. You know, typically, you know, when that is present, you're going to them with the early warning signs, not with the, oh my gosh, we just went off a cliff news, right? And so what you don't want to do with investors is big, bad surprises.
Yeah, no surprises.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean, I mean, it's ideally you go to them, so no surprises, and we have a problem. Here are the three things I think we could do to fix it, and I kind of recommend this one. That's kind of an ideal thing, but, you know, if you don't know, it's better to go anyway instead of faking it, right, and say, hey, you know what? I need help.
Rules are always be proactive about it.
Yep.
Come with suggestions, solutions. Ideally,
if you don't,
but that
still
does
come.
Not negate rule number
right.
one.
Still come. Yeah.
Still come.
And the preceding fact is have a relationship where that's not gonna be an impediment to you having that conversation.
And I have seen the most incredible response from board members in the worst possible situations. Mm. Because those right conditions were present.
So we've only got about 10 or 15 minutes, and we do want to hear a little more, Scott, about how you ended up at NEA, what makes NEA different from the firms that we walk around, and kind of your story into this profession. You talked about doing this for many, many years. How do you do this for, is it 20-something, 30 years now?
I think I'm in my 29th year.
29th year doing this. Tell us about why you got into it, why NEA, and
why are you still doing it?
Why are you still doing it?
Well, first of all, I was obviously lucky, right? You know, this is a huge privilege to get to do this. If you think about what we do for a living, we have the privilege of investing someone else's money in someone's dreams. And then we get to help them realize those dreams.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the essence of what we do. And there's nothing more invigorating than that, especially when you consider the nature of the problems that the entrepreneurs are trying to solve.
Yeah.
Which is so cool. I mean, so my story is that going back a little, I grew up in a middle-class family in Connecticut. I went to public high school, went to college. I was an engineer in college. Somewhere early on in my career and as an engineer, I realized I didn't want to be an engineer. I had a summer job where I was working in a civil engineering company and all the engineers were in cubicles. Hmm. I was like, I don't want to spend my life in a cubicle. So then I finished the engineering program, but I asked one of my engineering professors, you know, I don't think I want to be an engineer. What should I do? You know, I think I'm interested in business, but I have no idea. Like, what's business? And he said, well, you should try consulting. You'll get exposed to a lot of stuff. So anyway, I ended up at BCG for a couple of years. That was a fabulous experience. Loved it. But here again, early on at BCG, like within a couple of months, two things dawned on me. One was, you know, we're giving advice to people, but they're the ones who make the decisions. They're the ones who are accountable. And ultimately, the value is created by them.
Yeah.
I want to be in a job where I'm accountable. So that was my first takeaway. My second was they had a terrible lifestyle. They're on the road all the time. I want to have a family and be a good father. So that's not going to work. So I went on from there, and I had an opportunity to join a startup software company called Cat Software, Computer Aided Trading Systems. This is 1988, and it was in Palo Alto. They sent me to London on the first day as the first salesman to sell packaged software for currency and interest rate swap traders. Back in the day, this was the early day of the swap market. It was a big business for international banks. Super exciting, but very challenging couple of years. As I think I mentioned, the company ultimately went public on NASDAQ and paid for me to go to Stanford Business School, which was great. That company did end up getting venture funded about the time I left. And I sort of had this idea of what a venture capitalist was a little bit about.
Who was the firm?
That was Sutter Hill, I think.
Okay. Wow.
No, they're not bad.
Yeah.
Yep. And so in business school, I thought I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I ended up working at Microsoft over the summer and went back to Microsoft. But because my wife was here, I came back here and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was thinking about starting a business in 1994. And I came up with some ideas, but none of them were ones I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing. So I was doing consulting assignments along the way to pay the bills. Hmm. And one of those companies needed to raise money. We went to NEA. And we first went to the Baltimore office and they said, oh, this is really, and the entrepreneurs had me package it up and pitch it to the, the venture firms. So I did the pitch. And so they said, Peter Barris, who was my predecessor as managing partner at NEA, said, well, okay, that's interesting. Why don't you guys go out and see our partners in Menlo Park? So we went out next week to Menlo Park. And after that, a couple of days go by and Tom McConnell, one of the partners here, called me, says, let's have lunch. Hmm. So we have lunch and he says, you know, we're not really interested in that company, but would you like to work here? So that's what led to NEA.
How cool.
What did they like about you?
I have no idea.
Did the pitch go really well?
You know what?
Yeah, you didn't like you.
Sterling, they were so unsure of their decision to hire me that I had to meet pretty much everybody in the firm before they got to yes.
That's awesome.
So you kind of stumble into it, weren't actually trying to do it, and now you've been doing it for 29 years. Why are you still doing it today? What you love the game, it sounds like. What do you love about it? What's driving you now?
It's such a privilege to do. And it's so much fun to help other people succeed and build, you know, enduring companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, really hard.
Yeah.
As you guys well know. But it's super exciting when it happens. And along the way, you know, I'm kind of a workaholic, but I do get occasionally to go opportunities to do fun things. And about 10 years ago, I took a sabbatical. And, you know, I probably could have retired then. And people were worried when I went on my sabbatical, is he going to come back? And I took 4 months off. And my biggest conclusion from the sabbatical was, I like work better than all these fun things.
Funny how that works. So you've been through a bunch of upturns, downturns. We're going through kind of one right now. what's your sense of how this downturn is different from the past? How is it similar? And kind of what's your sense of where we're at in the cycle?
Yeah. Well, they're all different. Each downturn is different. You know, the big ones I lived through before were the dot-com collapse in 99, 2000, and then obviously the global financial crisis. Yeah. If you go back and you look at those two things, what was true in 1999 and 2000 is that we had a tech bubble that collapsed, but the rest of the economy was fine.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty complete collapse. Like, it went way up and went way down. NASDAQ down, I don't know, 98%. The venture ecosystem was decimated. It took a long time to recover. And then in the global financial crisis, a little bit the opposite, right? It was the macro picture where there was huge disturbance. The venture business didn't really get impacted that much, other than from a fundraising standpoint, everybody got scared. But interestingly, like, a lot of the companies that were started in 2007, 2008, 2009 did really well, because the financial crisis itself wasn't that dramatic as an impact on the tech business.
Mm-hmm.
I think this one feels a little bit more akin, at least at this moment, to the 1999-2000, because we've had this long tech run-up and then a tech correction.
And then now we're back up. And like, NASDAQ's near all-time. Well,
that's another story. But the macro economy's been actually doing reasonably well, despite inflation, despite interest rates and everything else. Yeah. Now, the big question, of course, is, does that continue? Do we have a soft landing and so on? And I'm not a macro economist, so I'm not going to speculate on that. But I think that what is clear is what's happening to the tech ecosystem, right? And we know, if you look at the peak year 2021, there were $770 billion of distributions from U.S. venture capital firms back to their LPs. Last year was something like $60 billion. Huge fall off. Well, you can't expect the LPs to give you more money if you don't give them the money they gave you the last time. So, you know, fundraising has gone from $450 billion in 2021 to $60 billion last year. And I think for structural reasons that I can get into if you want, I think it's going to be a while before the LPs start committing sizable dollars back to the venture industry. So we're in this period where the $300 billion or so of dry powder that existed at the start of last year, you know, is burning off at $150 billion or so a year, and it's going to burn off pretty fast. It's going to burn off by the end of next year, and then there's a day of reckoning, and we see, you know, how much capital comes into the industry and who do the LPs trust with that money.
And do you subscribe to the thinking that it will be concentrated on fewer firms who have longer track records, more established excellence, less first-time managers, kind of some of those kinds of things as LPs restrict a little bit?
Not necessarily. Okay. I think it's a little bit of a barbell, Sterling. I think there will be, I mean, these kinds of perturbations are an enormous test to the existing players, mm-hmm. right? And so I think there will be a fair amount of fallout, and we've seen it in this cycle already, and we've seen it in previous cycles from our limited partners, that they will, you know, that when they have to get back from an allocation of 30% to 20% or whatever, they cut managers. And so there will be, you know, a winnowing of the herd of existing established firms. But in every cycle, and it's certainly in this last one, there's all kinds of new managers that come along, and the LPs are always keeping an eye out for those new managers, because they're often innovative and do lots of great things. And so the ecosystem has always been a combination of this, you know, new sprouts of grass and the survivors from the last cycle.
So it's either be really good or be new and look like you could be really good, but if you were mediocre, that's where you're done.
Probably.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Makes sense. All right, we got a few minutes. We ask people kind of the same questions at the end of every conversation, and we'd love to ask you two or three questions here. Who is the investor that you admire most, or one of the investors that you admire most?
I'll name two people. One is my mentor, Dick Kramlich. When I came to NEA, I would hazard a guess, he's 88 now, I think, somewhere in there. He was about early 60s. So he's older than I am now. And he was the first guy in the office every day. He was the last guy out, always. He was just, he had such a passion for the business. He was so committed to his companies and his entrepreneurs.
Did he found NEA?
One of the three founders.
Got it.
Yeah, NEA was founded by Dick, Frank Bonzel, and Chuck Newball. Got it. The other two were in Baltimore, which is why they're not as well known around here. But they all played a seminal role in creating what NEA is today. But, you know, Dick was my mentor because I was out here. And I just learned so much from him. Among the things that I admired most and which, you know, kind of seared into my brain was how much he respected everybody always, how much he was truly open-minded. I mean, imagine that, you know, you're already in your 60s, and he's the most open-minded guy in the room.
Pretty cool.
About what's possible. And he was always looking for, like, crazy things coming out of left field. There was no, you know, there was no fixed mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And he clearly just had the passion. And he's such a graceful human being. You know, everybody who knows him loves Dick Kramlich. So that's one.
Okay.
Number two is John Doerr.
Right across the street here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've been so fortunate to work with John for 20 something years now. We've been on a couple different boards together. And he's probably the best of all time.
What makes him so damn good? What is it?
He's obviously really, really bright guy, driven, charismatic, dreams big. I mean, if I had to think about one thing that characterizes John, you know, everybody else is aiming to get this high in the sky, and John is aiming to get way the heck up there. And when you think about that as your goal, you just do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And he is always aspiring to something that is just next level. And he puts in next level commitment to do it. I mean, I've seen, just to give you one example, we were founding investors in Coursera, both of us were. And we were on the board. He just retired from the board last year. So long run. I remember at one point we needed to recruit a new CEO. And we somehow had come across the fact that Rick Levin was possibly available. Rick Levin was the president of Yale for 23 years and had just retired. And the idea that we could get Rick Levin to be the CEO of Coursera is, you know, a dream, you know, crazy, right? But somehow we were in like a search committee call, and the recruiter said, Rick is going to be in Washington, D.C., like, I think it was like tomorrow or something. He's only available for breakfast. John's like, I'll meet him for breakfast. Hmm. He flew overnight to Washington, D.C., to meet Rick Levin for breakfast and flew back. We got Rick.
That's awesome. All right, flip side of the investor question. I'll let Sterling ask this one.
Well, it's the same question, but entrepreneurs that you admire.
Oh my gosh. Most.
And I know they're all your favorites, but like,
this is a hard question.
We started with Frank
Sloan. Well, we've already talked about some of them, okay?
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, you know, Christian Chabot at Tableau.
Yeah.
Okay. Frank Slootman. Who I got to know through Data Domain. How about K.R. Schreeder, you know, who's still the CEO of Bloom Energy after 20-something years?
Wild.
I mean, that guy has been, there's a couple different ways to gauge things, but one of them is the degree of difficulty of the climb. And if you look at the mountain that guy climbed, that was a much tougher pitch than almost anybody I've ever seen in this business, period. And he never gave up, and he faced, you know, threats to the company's existence more times than I can remember. He was one of those entrepreneurs that had such a great relationship and trust with his board that when he really needed it, they were there for him. He's the poster child for that. Like somebody, he should write a book about that question. Anyway, K.R. Schreeder's clearly one of them. I mean, you know, Matthew Prince, we both know, you know, incredible, and Michelle, both of them together.
Mm-hmm.
Neither, the company's not successful without the pair of them.
Yeah.
Michelle's one of the most impressive people I've ever talked to in my life, period.
Sterling, I remember once, I don't know what the topic was, but Michelle and I were both invited to go speak at something, and it was some arcane subject matter that I didn't really know that much about. And I don't think Michelle knew that much about it either. But the two of us, and it's a like a big deal kind of conference or something. And Michelle gets up there and she just nails it. She has studied this thing like backwards and forwards. She became an expert, super articulate. And I'm like, I'm just an idiot.
Funny, I've heard people say the same thing about her like 10 times.
I have pages and pages of notes that I reread from.
We should get her on the podcast.
Yeah, we need to. So the last question was what we call the Golden Spur question. Mm. It's basically, why are you the way you are? What formed you? You talked actually about in your process.
It's the same
You're
question.
You're sussing it out for others, for founders. But what made you the way that you are and what motivates you?
Well, some of it I don't know. You know, I asked my parents once, they were talking about one of my siblings, and they said, you know, they had to kind of encourage this particular sibling along the way or whatever. And I said, well, what was I like? What did you? And they're like, you? Oh my God, no. You were like just driven like crazy from the beginning.
Yeah.
But I learned when I was 42 that I'm dyslexic. My oldest daughter is dyslexic, and in the process of diagnosing her, I was diagnosed as being dyslexic, and it made everything make sense about my childhood because I failed third grade basically, and I had a lot of trouble in school early on, and people thought I was stupid. I thought I was stupid because people told me I was stupid. So, you know, you have to do a lot to overcome that. And happily, as we now know, and I would commend anyone to read The Dyslexic Advantage by Brock and Fernetti Day, which talks about the advantages of being dyslexic and not just the disadvantages, but those start to accumulate as you go on in life and things became more complicated and the dyslexic brain is pretty good at figuring that stuff out and it has a bunch of features that are pretty nifty. So I do attribute a lot to having to overcome hardship.
Early.
This has been awesome. Thanks for the convo, Scott. I wish we had more time,
but this
was
great.
This is really cool.
Appreciate the time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
So, just wrapped up conversation with Scott. What were your biggest takeaways?
I didn't know he hired Frank Slootman for his first CEO job. I think one of my takeaways is that guy has more awesome stories about startups than maybe anybody. And you can tell why entrepreneurs want to work with him. He has this like warm, trusting, kind storytelling demeanor that makes it very fun. I can probably get into some specifics that we should take away from it, but the general sense was that was a very fun call.
What are a few of the specifics that stand out?
The relationship with the board being like a very important part of this dynamic of building a company. That's one. Another one is, you know, we talk about this in like every podcast, but it comes down to great people.
Yeah.
And then how he's recognizing great people with his specific question on historical to get you to this point and forward looking. And he draws a line through that. I think that question is incredible.
Same. Like I thought the process for identifying exceptional people that's been developed and tested for 3 decades.
Yeah.
I thought was, and by the way, because they're people at the end of the day, so simplicity is elegance. And so being able to point to what adversity have you overcome, what excellence have you achieved, and where do you want your life to go, and using that as a barometer for who to invest in, I thought was fantastic. I also thought the advice around how do you deliver bad news founders to investors, and he said like these are professional investors, they know bad news is coming, but they're really looking at you for how you're going to handle those moments when they do arise. And so I thought all that was very useful.
Yeah, another theme is like how grateful he is to be doing the job that he does, and you see that in all of our podcast conversations is that these people love what they do and that drives them to be great at it. That's why he's great at it. He loves doing it.
Yeah, craftsman.
Craftsman. He's a craftsman. Wants to be better.
I thought from the Tableau story there was a lot of fascinating takeaways. the being very purposeful in the foundation of what you build, both from a team perspective,
to build for enduring,
culture perspective, like an underlying technology, like all of those kinds of things. I thought that was a very interesting takeaway, especially today when it feels like everything's just get as big as you can, as fast as you can. I thought that there were some really sage lessons there.
Agree. We said it right after, but that maybe was the best one, or one of the best ones we've done. And so hopefully you all feel the same.